So our passage this morning is the one we read, Exodus chapter 8. And in these chapters of Exodus that we're in just now, there are basically two things driving the plot. On the one hand, a promise, the Israelites are going to depart from Egypt, and on the other hand, opposition, the Israelites not being allowed to depart from Egypt. And that being so, two characters are key: God and Pharaoh. Other characters are involved, of course, Moses and Aaron, the magicians, and so on, but God and Pharaoh are the key ones. And that's reflected then in the shape of our sermon this morning. We're just going to look at two main things. Number one, the strategic plagues sent by God, and number two, the stubborn pride shown by Pharaoh. Those are our two headings. Let's, without further ado, get down to business. So first of all, the strategic plagues sent by God. The strategic plagues sent by God. I wonder whether you've ever read the account of the 10 plagues and thought to yourself something like this: if I were God, with no limit to my power, the whole universe at my disposal, and 10 opportunities to torment this nation and this king that are being so defiant, if I were God, I think I would have been a bit more imaginative. To be sure, the whole thing gets off to a cracking start. Plague number one hits the spot all right, the turning of the great River Nile into blood. That's dramatic and impressive and spectacular. But the other plagues don't all live up to that, and especially the three that immediately follow, the three that we have in chapter 8 here. Frogs, gnats, flies. It almost seems as though God gets stuck in a rut here, a small species of wildlife kind of rut. And he finishes with the frogs. And he can't be bothered to come up with anything very fresh, and so he just kind of lazily reaches for a variation on the same theme and sends gnats. And once they're done, his creative juices have dried up even more, so that the flies he sends next barely differ at all from the creature that has preceded them. I wonder if that's ever been your reaction. Put in God's place, I would have made a better choice of plagues. Well, what I want to show you in this first part of our sermon is that these three plagues we have here are in fact very well chosen by God. They are not unimaginative and lazy. There's a careful rationale behind each one. They are highly strategic plagues. Let me put it this way. These are not just frogs and gnats and flies. These are specifically sacred frogs, awkward gnats, and free-range flies. I'll explain what I mean with each of those in turn. First of all, then, sacred frogs. Sacred frogs. Now, in our culture, we're not hugely enthusiastic about frogs. As children, we learn the fairy tale, The Frog Prince, and in that story then it's deeply unfortunate that the handsome prince is having to live as a frog. It's the result of a curse, and it means that humans don't like him, and the princess doesn't want him in her castle. Indeed, the happy ending in that tale isn't the prince realizing he's actually better off as a frog and becoming reconciled to that form of existence. It's him ceasing to be a frog, leaving his frogness behind. That's the happy ending. In our culture, we don't mind frogs living in ponds at the bottom of our gardens, but we don't put these creatures on a pedestal. We don't elevate them to lofty heights of dignity and kudos. But some cultures do, or at least some cultures did. These are the words of a very distinguished 20th century scholar and expert in ancient Egypt. He says, "The frog appears to have been worshipped in primitive times as the symbol of generation, birth, and fertility in general. The cult of the frog is one of the oldest in Egypt, and the frog god and the frog goddess were believed to have played very prominent parts in the creation of the world." And you see now what an interesting plague, then, this plague at the beginning of chapter 8 is. God is unleashing on Egypt these creatures which the Egyptians worshipped. Now, one implication of that may have been that the Egyptians refused to kill any of these frogs, meaning that the plague was allowed to fulfill its maximum potential. If it had been an infestation of rats, for instance, then they might have engaged in some pest control techniques and in that way taken the edge off the plague and mitigated it a little. But what pious Egyptian was going to lay down poison for the frogs that were running amok in his house? That would be sacrilege to do that. But as well as ensuring that the plague isn't brought under any kind of control then, God, by sending frogs of all things, he's doing something else as well. He's creating two very telling scenes. Scene number one, the Egyptians overrun by the thing that they worship. It's described vividly in verse 3, isn't it? Frogs in their houses, in their bedrooms, in their beds, in their ovens, in their kneading bowls that they use for baking. In other words, the thing that they worship becoming uncontrollable, getting everywhere, taking over everything. That's one powerful scene. And then scene number two, the Egyptians gathering in heaps the thing that they worship. That's in verse 14, because Moses has prayed now and the plague has ended. But it has ended not through a Pied Piper figure leading the frogs away in a very clean and convenient fashion. It has ended through them dying and the remains of these myriad creatures thus having to be dealt with. In every house up and down the land, men and women taking sweeping brushes to this thing that they worship and forming pathetic, ugly, stinking heaps in their backyards. And I would put it to you this morning that those two scenes are actually timelessly relevant. Because, you know, everyone worships. Everyone worships. You may be here at this service this morning, but you're not particularly into any religion. And so you don't consider yourself to be a worshipper. You would never use that term to describe yourself. But you are a worshipper. Everyone is. If you're not worshipping the God who made you and who at this very moment is enabling your every breath, if you're not worshipping him, then you're worshipping something else. And in your case, that something else probably isn't frogs. It might be money. It might be success in your particular field. It might be the physical beauty with which you've been blessed. But there's something that you are putting at the center of your life and elevating to the place of supreme importance. And this is the thing. If you are worshipping something other than the God who made you, the same two things will happen as I pointed out just now in our passage. Number one, your life will be overrun by the thing that you worship. You will never feel you have enough money, enough success, enough beauty. And the need to get more of that thing will drive you to increasingly extreme and destructive measures. Like the frogs affecting every aspect of life, the thing that you worship will start to affect your health, your family, your friendships, your temperament, your sleep at night. You won't be able to keep it under control. It will take control of you. C.S. Lewis wrote that love, having become a god, becomes a demon. And the same is true of anything else that becomes a god in our lives. It turns into a monster that we can't get away from for one single moment, day or night. That's the first thing that will happen if you are worshipping something that isn't the God who made you. Your life will be overrun by it. And then number two, it will end up in heaps. It will end up in heaps. The money will slip through your fingers. The success will suddenly be swallowed up in some disastrous experience a failure. The beauty will disappear. The thing that you live for will crash. It will go the same way as these sacred frogs there in verse 14. If it doesn't happen within life itself, and it may well, it will certainly happen when you die. Your death will reduce that thing that you've worshipped to a silly, pathetic, ridiculous nothingness. It will end up in heaps. My urgent plea to you this morning then is this: worship God. Put Him at the center of your life. Don't worship something else, some modern equivalent of the Egyptians' frogs, which like them will horribly take over your life and which like them will eventually leave you in the lurch. Worship God. Worship God. So that's the sacred frogs. Then we have awkward gnats. Awkward gnats. The striking thing about this plague is that it's the one which stretches the magicians to their breaking points. It seems strange that, doesn't it? The production of all these gnats doesn't feel like a significantly greater display of divine power to the than the plagues that have preceded it, the blood and the frogs. So why should it be the one then which suddenly leaves these magicians floundering? Well, we need to remember what we've said before, that the magicians aren't actually doing something supernatural at all. They are merely performing tricks. Now, suppose they were doing something supernatural. Suppose they had a bit of supernatural power, at least. Not loads, but a bit. In that case, their ability to replicate each plague would depend on the degree of supernaturalism involved in that plague. And there would be no particular reason why the gnats should flummox them when the blood hadn't flummoxed them and the frogs hadn't flummoxed them. But as I say, these are mere tricksters, which means that their ability to replicate each plague doesn't depend on the supernaturalism involved in that plague. It depends solely on whether the plague's details are easy to fake or not easy to fake. Now, blood is easy enough to fake. With frogs, you can at least catch them and release them in such a way that it perhaps looks a little bit like you produced them from nowhere. Gnats are much harder to work with. Hard to catch, hard to keep alive once caught, hard to release in such a way that they will fly in the direction that you want them to fly in order to impress the onlookers that you've gathered in the room. They're just awkward customers. And so again, you see, this plague isn't random. It's God just very subtly outstretching the capabilities of these silly magicians. Almost, I think we can reverently say, playing with them. I love verse 18 there, the way it stresses the magicians tried by their secret arts to produce gnats. You see, God could have dramatically left these magicians behind here, couldn't he? He could have sent an electric storm or something as the next plague. Something just cosmically impressive, and the magicians wouldn't have even been able to begin to try to replicate that. They would have just had to concede defeat straight away. But God does it in a way that's more funny. We're meant to read verse 18 and smile as we picture these magicians getting into all sorts of problems, attempting to control gnats, probably getting very flustered in the process, probably getting bitten in the process, eventually having to face up to the fact that these awkward insects have simply gotten the better of them. It's not a random play. God here is just subtly overstretching the magicians in a humorous way. So sacred frogs, awkward gnats, and then we also have free-range flies. The striking thing about this next plague, the flies, is that division that's mentioned in verse 23. The fact that the Egyptians were going to experience this plague, but the Israelites in the land of Goshen, that's one area of Egypt, were not. Now, God could have done that with the frogs and with the gnats, but that wouldn't have been quite as impressive as God doing that with the flies. You see, both of them, the frogs and the gnats, they're both connected, aren't they, with a particular place of origin. In the case of the frogs, it's the Nile. They come out of the Nile, we're told. In the case of the gnats, notice, it's the dust of the earth, isn't it? The dust in verse 17 becomes gnats, which probably implies that this has been done in a desert area of Egypt. Plenty of desert in Egypt. And probably then it's there that Moses and Aaron are initiating this particular plague. And that those factors probably meant then that there were more frogs in some parts of Egypt than in others, the nearer you got to the Nile. And there were more gnats in some parts of Egypt than in others. If you were out in the desert particularly, where Moses and Aaron had caused this plague to first happen, there were probably more there. There was a certain unevenness, I'm saying, about the distribution of the frogs and of the gnats. Flies, on the other hand. The flies here, they're not connected to any particular place of origin. Not the Nile. Not the desert. Not anywhere. They just come from nowhere. And so they aren't more likely to be in one part of Egypt than another part of Egypt. They're just free-range flies. And the fact then that they, of all things, the flies, don't set foot in the land of Goshen, don't enter Goshen's airspace, that's awe-inspiring to a greater degree than would have been the case if the frogs hadn't gone near Goshen, or if the gnats hadn't gone near Goshen. Again, God has carefully chosen the precise nature, I'm saying, of this plague. It's not just, oh, I'll send some other form of wildlife now. There's a precision here about God's selection of the plagues. And then stopping the flies from entering Goshen, God isn't just highlighting his awesome control of things, although he is doing that. And by the way, that comes across again in verse 31, doesn't it? Where you have that wonderful detail at the end. It says in verse 31, the Lord did as Moses asked and removed the swarms of flies from Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people. Not one remained. God really is sovereign over every last individual fly. That's what that verse is saying. We think sometimes perhaps that things like that job interview I've got coming up, or that lump I found somewhere in my body, those things might somehow slip through the net of God's sovereign control. We've been reminded in verse 31 that even an individual fly doesn't slip through the net of God's sovereign control. But God keeping the flies out of Goshen, as I say, it's not just highlighting God's awesome control of things. Look at verse 23. This is God speaking to Pharaoh through Moses. Thus I will put a division between my people and your people. What's God saying there to Pharaoh? He's saying, Pharaoh, I'm a better protector of my people than you are of your people. You might be the greatest king on this planet, Pharaoh, but there are certain things that you cannot protect your people from. I can protect my people from anything. That's what God is saying there. And you know, that is true. That is true, and that is wonderful. It's why so often we have in the Old Testament especially, but in the New Testament as well, that picture, don't we, of taking refuge under God's wings. That's what a believer is. A believer is someone who has taken refuge under God's wings. Have you taken refuge under God's wings? This wonderful comprehensive protector of his people. He will protect all who do so, all who take refuge under his wings. In fact, he will protect those who do so from the very worst thing that there is. What is the very worst thing that there is? The very worst thing that there is the experience of everlasting torment in hell. The very worst thing that there is you and I receiving the consequences that we deserve for the lives we have lived of breaking God's rules. That's the worst thing. But if you take refuge under God's wings, then even that will not touch you. In this case, because he himself, God the Son, Jesus Christ, at the cross of Calvary, bore all that everlasting hell, so that those taking refuge beneath his wings would never bear it. Have you come under his wings? This one who can say to Pharaoh, your people are going to get hurt here, my people won't. I can protect my people. Have you come to him? And have you run under these wonderfully protective wings of his? So that's the first and the main thing this morning then, the strategic plague sent by God. Not random, not arbitrary, not pathetic, not unimaginative, but these carefully chosen plagues, sacred frogs, awkward gnats, free range flies. But having considered the strategic plague sent by God, let's consider more briefly the stubborn pride shown by Pharaoh. As this chapter unfolds, Pharaoh kind of unravels before our eyes. What we see here throughout chapter 8 is Pharaoh losing more and more ground. Let me show you. It begins with him no longer able to deny the Lord. Remember chapter 5 verse 2, when Moses and Aaron first went to meet Pharaoh and they began, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. And this is Pharaoh's reply, chapter 5 verse 2, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and moreover I will not let Israel go. Who's the Lord? Who's this Yahweh? Who's this God you're on about? Basically denying he's of any consequence, any significance whatsoever. Pharaoh's not doing that in verse 8 of chapter 8 here, is he? Plead with the Lord to take away the frogs from me and from my people. He's not denying Yahweh now. You don't ask for prayer to a God that you consider to be an irrelevance, an inconsequential no God. Also, by the way, that's tacit acknowledgement by Pharaoh, isn't it, that the magicians haven't really produced any frogs supernaturally. Because if the magicians have supernaturally produced frogs, then there's no reason why they couldn't also supernaturally remove the frogs. But he doesn't seem to have any hope of them removing them. No, Yahweh has to do it, because Yahweh is the only participant in this whole scene who has really produced any frogs. And so Pharaoh then, already there, starting to lose ground. He can no longer deny the Lord. Next, we see him no longer able to counter the miracles. No longer able to counter the miracles. As we've just said, Pharaoh had doubtless known all along that the magicians were just doing tricks. He wasn't concerned that they should do genuine miracles equivalent to what Yahweh was doing through Moses and Aaron. He just needed something at least that he could point to, so that in the face of all these miracles, he wasn't just standing there passively looking stupid. He needed something he could point to that would satisfy others. He knew that they weren't genuine, but that would satisfy others that what Yahweh was doing, his men could also do. But now he can't even do that. With the gnats, and henceforth, He can't even do that. Now he doesn't even have the slenderest pretext anymore for denying the godness and the power of Yahweh. By the way, the magicians themselves kind of give the game away somewhat, don't they? It's a bit of a faux pas when they say in verse 19, this is the finger of God. In other words, they're saying, well, we can't compete with this now. We can't compete when it comes to gnats because this is the finger of God that we're up against. Well, they're men who are supposed to have been doing their stuff by the finger of God all along, but they're basically admitting here, well, we don't know anything of the finger of God in our experience. That's not how we operate. We're tricksters. And so Pharaoh, I'm saying, he's unraveling a bit more now. Already he can no longer deny the Lord. Now he can no longer counter the miracles, even in just a slight and a slender and a tenuous way. And then finally we see him no longer able to rule the conversation. No longer able to rule the conversation. I mean the conversation with Moses and Aaron. So far the trend has been this, hasn't it? Moses and Aaron proposing things, Pharaoh saying no. That's how it's worked so far, this dialogue between them and him. But now in verses 25 to 27, it's reversed, isn't it? Now we have Pharaoh proposing there in verse 25, go sacrifice to your God within the land. And we have Moses saying, no, not going to do that, can't do that. You see, the balance of power is shifting here in this dialogue. By the way, what Moses says there in verse 26, it fits, I think. What we know when he says that the offerings we shall sacrifice to the Lord our God are an abomination to the Egyptians. I've commented before on how we know, don't we, that shepherding was an abomination to the Egyptians. We're told that explicitly in Genesis 46 verse 34, and doubtless then offering sheep and goats as sacrifices to a god was an abomination to the Egyptians. What an irony. These people who worship frogs looking down their noses at those who offer sheep and goats in sacrifices to their gods. Perhaps a little bit reminiscent of certain things we see in our own context today, the way in which our society will celebrate all kinds of perversions and then look with such suspicion on those who love the Bible. But you see then what I'm saying, the way in which Pharaoh just gradually loses more and more ground as chapter 8 unfolds. And you think then, well, surely he has to concede now. He has to admit defeat. He has to let the Israelites go. His position is becoming so compromised, so weakened. Surely he has to do it. And kind of at each point along the way then of chapter 8, we're thinking as readers, well, this must be the moment. Now he's going to say, okay, I give in, go. But of course, in each case, again and again, we read verse 15, Pharaoh hardened his heart. Verse 19, his heart was hardened. And of course, it's how our passage ends. Verse 32, Pharaoh hardened his heart this time also. It's a bit like that Monty Python scene that some of you will be aware of with the Black Knight and King Arthur is wanting to cross this river and he encounters this black knight and the black knight won't let him across and is fighting King Arthur and King Arthur chops off an arm of the black knight and he carries on fighting. So he chops off another arm, carries on fighting, chops off a leg and keeps on fighting, chops off another leg. He's just a torso left, but he still won't give up and keeps saying things like, "'Tis but a scratch." I've had worse, it's just a flesh wound, things like that. And Pharaoh kind of reminds you a bit of that here, this ridiculous position that he's in. He's losing more and more ground, yet he won't give up, still fighting, still won't say, you can go now. Why? Why is Pharaoh like that? Well, yes, as we've commented before, there may be economic reasons that it's against his interest to let the Israelites go. They're the slave people who are building all these cities for him and driving the industry of Egypt, and they'll suffer perhaps, the Egyptians, if they lose that workforce. Then again, there may be some national security fears. If the Israelites are allowed to leave, they might then turn on the Egyptians and come back and fight against them. Perhaps those reasons are at play, but I think the deepest reason is the one I indicated in my heading just now. It's Pharaoh's stubborn pride. That's the ultimate reason. It's Pharaoh's stubborn pride. And I say that because I think we get a glimpse of that a couple of times in this passage. The first is in verse 10. And that's a fascinating verse. You know, Moses has said in verse 9, okay, I'll plead with God to remove the frogs. When do you want them to go, Pharaoh? Now, surely it's a no-brainer. He's going to say, well, as soon as possible, please. In the next hour, will that be okay? Certainly by the end of today. What does he respond? Tomorrow. Tomorrow. What on earth is he doing? And the commentators are a bit puzzled by that. I think probably the best answer is that he's just being stubborn. And he just wants to hang on to a little bit of control. And even though it's to his disadvantage, and it means he's going to have to endure the frogs a bit longer, he wants to at least retain a bit of control because of this stubborn pride that's there within his heart. The other moment is verse 28, where we've just seen Pharaoh in verse 25 says, you can go, but stay in the land. Moses won't have that, so Pharaoh comes back with his next proposal in verse 28. I will let you go into the wilderness. And then there's that wonderfully kind of vague and meaningless phrase with which he ends, only you must not go very far away. Kind of reminds you of some of the COVID regulations we've had, doesn't it? Kind of how far you're allowed to go. Well, not too far, not very far. And what's Pharaoh doing? I think, again, it's just a face-saving device, as one of the commentators calls it. That he can't bring himself to say in explicit terms, okay, you're allowed to go. Because that would be too much of a blow to his ego, to his pride. And so he says you can go in such a way that it looks like he's still got a little bit of control over the situation. And so those two little glimpses show us, I think, what's driving this man and why it is that in verse 32, even though now he seems to have nothing left, he's so compromised, he's still not allowing them to go. It's pride, stubborn pride that's driving him. He doesn't want to acknowledge that there's a greater king than him. That there's a king before whom he must bow. A king to whom he must comply. He doesn't want to acknowledge that. That's a hard and a painful thing for him to acknowledge. Now, as we close then, none of you are kings being confronted by God's demand to let his people go. None of you is in that situation that Pharaoh is in here. But God is calling you this morning to be a worshipper of him, the living and true God. He is calling you this morning to serve him and put him first in your life and to live the rest of your days for his glory. He is calling you to do that. And perhaps you then are doing a Pharaoh this morning in that context. Perhaps even like him, you know that it's all true. Pharaoh knows that now. He knows that there is a Yahweh, and that this Yahweh is unspeakably great because he can do all these things that nobody else can do. He knows the truth. It's not a problem of information. It's not a problem of knowledge that Pharaoh has here. It's a problem of heart. And perhaps this morning, you've been here enough times. You know that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. You know he's the Son of God. You know it's all true. But still there's something that's holding you back from bowing the knee to God and giving your life to him. There's a pride there that won't let you do it. I'm saying, discard that pride this morning. Discard that pride. Dispense with that pride. Don't be foolish. Don't be a Pharaoh. Don't cling to a sense of control. Instead, come to God this morning and say, in the words of the old hymn, King of my life, I crown thee now. Amen. Robert is going to play for us a hymn as we close our service. It's number 500.